All right, welcome to class today. Glad to see you all here. Before we begin, are there comments, questions, concerns, other things for me? Okay. Of course, as they come along, feel free to either unmute yourself and interrupt me, or to pop them in the chat, whichever you would prefer, and I will do my best to answer them. Let's look a little bit at where we sit in the schedule. So if you look at this, you'll see that we have this week and next, basically, we're going to talk about how to count things in various ways, summations, combinations, permutations, and then some proofs about those sorts of things. So we will have that. We will also try to spend some time on Wednesday. We will have sort of a dry run. Can you get things to submit for the replacement in class quiz? And then we will actually try that in our regular class time on Friday. So it'll still have that same start time, end time, and so on as an in-class quiz would. And there's a chance that will fail. And if that fails, we will just drop that quiz and move on in some way, meaningful way. We'll drop that quiz and use a different model for the ones that follow. But what I don't want to do is end up causing our in-class quizzes to take large amounts of your time. And so I do want to try to keep them in this sort of narrow window as best we can. So we'll do a dry run of the system on Wednesday, and then we will have it actually happen on Friday. If you're in a time zone where the time that I'm giving this lecture is not the appropriate time for you, please email me at your earliest convenience and let me know what time zone you're in and what times would work so we can make appropriate adjustments. The material that follows that, the next 3 weeks of material you'll see here, we will see how well that goes. We may remove some of that material if things seem to be moving a little slower, but I think we'll be able to get through that and finish most of our material. This class, the last day of class, that Monday, and then also the Thursday that follows our final exam time, both of those will be opportunities to replace your grade in portions of the course. So if you go to the progress tracker, you can go see your detailed progress report, and it will show you how you're doing in different areas, and that'll be a time to replace that. It has come to my attention recently that of the three places I had computed your class standing, your current grade so far, two of them agreed with how they were computing it, and one of them disagreed. I have made them all agree with the one that was listed on our course policies page. I'm unsure if it's the right boundaries, so we may adjust that. I do want to get a couple more evaluations graded before I sort of see how things are working here and make those final decisions. It won't go down, but it might go up. So your grade might boost a little bit once I make that evaluation, which I'm planning to do after we have graded probably Lab 10. So probably that will happen sometime around April 8th that we will decide if those boundaries are going to move. And if they move, they will move in your favor. Yeah, I think that is logistics kinds of stuff I wanted to say. So let us talk about the basic idea of counting. Counting is, of course, something that I'm assuming you have all been taught by somebody when you were a very small child. It is something we teach children at a young age, at least its basic version. We're going to learn some more advanced counting in this course because in computing, we want to count things that are difficult to count just by going 1, 2, 3, 4, etc. We want fancier ways of counting. For example, we might want to count the number of times an instruction runs in some piece of code. Now, we could certainly run the code and increment a counter and see how many times it ran, but often we're gonna wanna know how many times it will run before we run it for all possible inputs. So we can have a mathematical expression counting the number of times and something runs. We might also want to count, for example, we might wanna count the number of passwords that can exist given some limitations on what passwords look like. because if there are only a few million passwords that can be created with a particular scheme, then it only takes a few million guesses to guess every password. We want this to be a nice large number. Where instruction runs, we typically want small because this is correlated with speed. Our passwords, we typically want big. But again, we want to sort of count these in the abstract, even if they're huge numbers, potentially without running anything along the way. We might also want to count, for example, the bytes used by some data structure. To understand as data, as we have more and more data, how much memory do we need to store things and so forth. So you have lots of things we want to count where the numbers are so large, or we want to count them in sort of this abstract context and straightforward when 1 plus 1 plus 1 plus 1 is not the approach we want to use. So we're going to see various manifestations of this over the next several classes. However, we're going to start today with one of the simplest versions of this that is beyond straightforward counting, which we've actually seen before, and use it to talk a little bit about proofs. So let's talk again about our summation notation. We have seen summation notation before. I do want to point, and I'm going to review what we said before about it, and then we're going to do some other things. First thing to note, there are two basic formats of summation notation. One has limits above and below, and then an expression inside. And the other one has a set below that some value is a member of, and has the expression that we're dealing with. So this second one means added up for all of the elements of that set. That assumes that this set has to be discrete. If I were to put the real numbers here, it wouldn't make sense because I can't sort of enumerate all of the real numbers. But for the natural numbers or a subset of the natural numbers, this will work fine. This particular notation where we have limits below and above really means this is going to be sort of the same thing as saying for all I that are an element of the set of X where X is an element of the integers and X is greater than or equal to that one that we had here. Okay. And X is less than or equal to N, which came from there. Okay. So we can always write our summations in this element of notation instead with an appropriately complicated set. However, this is by far the more common notation, is the 1 to N notation. Shows up far more often in practice because very many cases where we come up with a sum, this is the kind of set that we're dealing with. It's a set of consecutive integers with a minimum and maximum element. So we have these two different notations. There's a few special cases that are worth understanding. So let's consider, for example, the sum of I in the empty set of I. If I add up all of the values inside the empty set, remember, of course, that this can also be written as just the empty curly braces. If I sum up all of the elements in the empty set, I have summed nothing. And by convention, when we sum nothing, we say that is zero. This is by convention in the sense that it is not officially defined in most contexts, and you can find occasional texts that will say this is sort of undefined, this it has to have members. But by far, this is what we mean when we're summing over an empty set. Because of that, if I were to say the sum from I equals 2 to 1 of I, this would also be 0. And this would be 0 because of the set definition I have given. I need to sum over all of the integers that are greater than or equal to 2 and less than or equal to 1. Well, that is the empty set. There are no integers greater than or equal to 2 and less than or equal to 1. So I'm going to get back the the empty set I'm summing over, meaning that I'm going to have 0 as my result. This may not be intuitive. Some people would expect us to sum backwards or have some sort of error code or the like, but the tradition is if your upper limit is smaller than your lower limit, then you have summed over no values at all. The other case here worth noting, if I have the same limit on top and bottom, I'm summing over just that one value because these are less than or equal, greater than or equal. And so if the top and bottom are both equal, I include that one limit. This is unlike how we most commonly write loops in most programming languages where one of the things is inclusive and the other is exclusive. In math, we typically make them both inclusive. And so this sum then would be 2. And if it was some fancier expression, x to the I, then we would have x to the 2, right? It's not just that number, it's whatever that expression is evaluated at that number. Okay. Thoughts, comments, questions about our definition of sums here? Oh, I guess I should also just remind you what the actual definition is, right? This is the sum of 1 plus 2 plus 3 plus n minus 1 plus n, right? And this is the sum of 1 over 2 to the 0 plus 1 over 2 to the 1 plus 1 over 2 to the 2 plus forever. Any questions about our summation notation before I move on and start talking about how we will prove things about these? Okay. Then let's start proving things about them. Let's take one of the most famous sums of all. The sum from I equals 1, nope, not n. From I equals 1 to n of I. This sum, if I sum consecutive integers starting at 1 up to some upper limit, I end up with n plus 1 over 2. I have a couple of questions. Let me back up. I thought 0 wasn't in the set of natural numbers. 0 is in the set of natural numbers. It is not in the set of whole numbers. There are other definitions of natural numbers that exist in some other context, but in computing, it is always in the set of natural numbers. Other questions? I should comment, there's a reason we call them the natural numbers, which might help you remember that 0 is included. It's all of the numbers that naturally occur. So it is common, it is natural to talk about having 0 trees, having 1 tree, having 2 trees. It is not natural or common to talk about having 1.3 trees. This is the concept behind the natural numbers. It's also not natural to say I have a negative 1 tree. When we think about real things that have identity, we typically think of them as being indivisible, hence integer, and starting at 0 on up, hence natural. Okay. So, I have this sum. And I am asserting that it has this value. There are several different ways of deriving that it has this value. And the textbook goes into a few of those methods. Those methods of figuring out what the value should be are not something we're going to spend much time or energy on in this class. Instead, we're going to show you this and then show you how you would prove that it was true or verify that it was false. Remember when I said earlier, I said when you're given a putative truth, something that somebody claims is true, you should always first try to find a counterexample. So, what I would like you to do now is just take this equation and just try it out for a few values of n. I would suggest using small values of n because it will be annoying at larger values to compute it all. But grab a piece of paper or some other way of noting it down and just try it out at a few different values of n. I would also encourage you to try sort of boundary values. You'll see we have this boundary of 1. If n was equal to 1 or less than 1, what does this equal and does it match? So take a moment, do that, and then we'll come back and talk about first your reactions to that. If something strikes you as odd, feel free to put it in chat or to unmute yourself and say it. And then in a moment, we'll talk about how to prove it, assuming it is true. All right, so we have a comment that suggests this works for 0 and negative 1, but not for negative 2. Which would suggest this would be true when n is in this set. I'm using ellipsis notation. This is not a formal definition of a set, but this sort of suggests this concept of a set. So let's just take a quick poll if we agree with this. If you'll go in your participant list, you can click either yes or no. Say yes if you believe this is the correct set where this is true, and no if you believe it is the incorrect set. Wow, it's really neck and neck. Yeses have a very slight lead. Nope, that lead just closed. Back up to tied. Oh, and now the no's are winning. Wow. We are split, really closely split, as to whether this is the correct set of things for which this converges or not. Okay. It looks like sort of our late entries are predominantly in the no case. What I want to know is what is an example of why this would be the wrong set. We have a bunch of people that think this is not the correct set. So either an example of a number outside the set for which it will also be true, or an example of a number in the set for which it will not be true. Can anybody give me such an example? Either unmute yourself or raise your hand or just put it in the chat. Okay, we have a suggestion that negative 1 it doesn't work for. Let's try it out at negative 1. So if I take the sum of I equals 1 to negative 1 of I, by the definition of sums, this is the sum of all integers that are greater or equal to 1, less than or equal to negative 1. There are no such integers, so this is going to be 0. If I take the other side, I take negative 1, negative 1 plus 1 over 2. This is going to be, this is the same thing as 0. 0 times 0 is 0, so this is going to also be 0. So I believe it actually does hold at negative 1, although I understand why you would initially assume it wouldn't. But given our odd definition we just gave for a lower upper bound than lower bound in our sums, and given we have this plus 1 that becomes 0, we have this situation. So before I move on to the next example that's been suggested, any questions or comments about why these are the same? Anything you'd like me to say more about this? Okay, let's try negative 2 has also been suggested. I equals 1 to negative 2 of I. Well, that also is going to be 0 because there is no number greater than or equal to 1, less than or equal to negative 2. So we still are summing over the empty set to get 0 there. And then my equation here is going to be negative 2 plus 1 over 2. which is going to be, okay, so that's going to be negative 1, which means this is going to turn into 2, which means that whole thing is going to be a 1. And so it is false for that number. And that number was not included in our initial set. So it appears that at least this side of the boundary seems to be correct. It's not immediately intuitive why this would be the case, which is part of the reason I do this, to try to help you build a different intuition about what's going on. Okay, so I have this peculiar result that it works for 0 because I'm going to have a 0 up here and no numbers. It works for negative 1 because I'm going to have a 0 there and no numbers. But it doesn't work for negative 2 because neither of those are zeroed out, even though the sum actually is. Any other thoughts, comments, questions, any other example numbers you would like me to work through, whether you believe they work or not? Anything else you would like to see for this example? Can we do 1? Absolutely. Sum from I equals 1 to 1 of I is going to be, well, so that is the sum of all the integers between 1 and 1. So that's just the number 1. Because the only number in that set is the number 1. And then on the right-hand side, we have 1 and 1 plus 1 over 2. Well, that's going to be 2. 1 times 2 is 2. 2 over 2 is 1. Why not? Let's do one more just so that we can see it. I equals 1 to 2 of I is going to be 1 plus 2. The sum of all the numbers greater than or equal to 1, less than or equal to 2. And if I do it on the other side, I've got 2. 2 plus 1 over 2. Okay, so this is equal to 3. 1 plus 2 is 3. This is equal to 3. And thus I see it holds there as well. Any other numbers you would like to see me do or other questions you have about this equation? All right. So we have this equation. We have this sum is equal to this as long as n is no smaller than negative 1 and is an integer. But how can we prove that it is true? Proofs of this is a case that actually falls very conveniently into proof by induction. Okay, so let's start with our theorem. We're going to say for all n in the natural numbers, we'll ignore the negative 1 case for now. It is the case that the sum from I equals 1 to n of I is equal to n, n plus 1 over 2. And then we're going to prove this by induction. As a reminder, when we're proving by induction, what we need to have is a base case, a specific example or a set of examples for which we know it is true. And then we need to have an inductive step, which says, if we knew it was true up to this n, we know it's also true for the next one, so that we can sort of get from that base case to everything else. So as we're going through here, our base case needs to include the smallest element. Okay, so we need to deal with n equals 0. If n equals 0, then the sum of I equals 1 to n I is equal to 0. And 0, 0 plus 1 over 2 is equal to 0. Okay, so I have that case. This is a case where there's probably not quite enough. I'm in the special case space for the sum. And so the special case, the case where I had an empty set, doesn't naturally lead itself to the place where I can move from one to the next. So I'm in this special case zone. I probably want a base case that is outside of the special case zone. It's in sort of the normal behavior of my sum as well. So let's just add another base case that behaves normally, where there is a value inside the sum. Whether we have to do this or not might vary by case, but it's always a safe assumption that you need to have a base case that includes the normal behavior of whatever you're discussing. It never hurts to do that, and it's often important to do. So we're going to do two base cases, the case zero and the case one. Now we've done those two base cases, now we can do the inductive step. Okay. Before I move on to the inductive step, any questions about what I've done so far? Okay. You know what? Let's do the inductive step over here so I have space for it, so we can see it all at the same time. So my inductive step always begins with an assumption. I assume the theorem is true at some particular value. So I'm going to assume that it's true for n equals k, just some arbitrary k. That is to say, I'm assuming that the sum of I equals 1 to k I is equal to k, k plus 1 over 2. Now, I'm not using n here because n was universally quantified to all natural numbers. K here is a particular k. I haven't told you what k it is, but I'm assuming I know some k for which it's true. I'm not going to be able to say that's everything, but I am going to be able to say, then I want to consider n equals k plus 1. I'm going to try to show that knowing that it's true at k tells me it's true at k plus 1. Which means I want to end up showing, somewhere down here, k plus 1 looks like k plus 1, k plus 2 over 2. I want to reach that goal. And I need to get there knowing this truth, using this assumption. Shouldn't we use a different variable for k plus 1 since k is already defined? Yes, sorry. I am not trying to say I have a variable that equals that. I'm considering the case where n equals k plus 1. So the comment was, if I were defining a variable to be k plus 1, I shouldn't use n. That is absolutely true. What I'm trying to say here is I'm thinking about the next case. Can I show that the next case is also true? Okay. So, how am I going to get there? How am I going to get from this expression to this expression? What I need to do here is I need to use some basic algebra to turn one sum into a different sum. And to do that, let's just briefly pause and do a little aside to explain the approach, and then we'll come back and see it in context. Okay, so if I consider this sum, I equals 1 to k of I, this is 1 plus 2 plus 3 plus k minus 1 plus k. And if I consider this sum, the other one we're dealing with, we want to get to this one. That is 1 plus 2 plus 3 plus k minus 1 plus k plus 1. And as I look at these two, they differ only in this final piece. It's only that final term's presence or absence that makes these two different. So if I were to add k plus 1, to this term. So if I were to say k plus 1 plus the sum of I equals 1 to ki, that is, by definition, the same thing as the sum I equals 1 to k plus 1 I. Because The only difference in these is the last element of the set, and I've added in that last element of the set on the side, so I can just move back and forth, change the bounds of my sum by adding or subtracting terms. Not actually limited to this, this is the one we're going to use in this case, but I can do this in other ways. If I had said, for example, the sum of I equals 1 to ki, I could, for example, add k plus 1, and I could add that in. I could subtract out a 1, I could subtract out a 2. I could add in a k plus 2. And my end result would be that I've removed the bottom 2, so I can start at 3. And I've added 2 more above, so I can go up to k plus 2 and make my new sum. So by adding and subtracting terms on the boundaries, we can move where those boundaries are in our sum. And I can do that however I want. The one I want in particular is to turn my k to k plus 1 so I can make my proof. So this is going to be the version of moving the boundaries that we're going to want to use. Before we go back and apply this, questions about this approach? Oh yeah, no, that's the same question I saw, sorry. Any questions about this approach? How did I get the lower boundary? Well, so notice here I have the subtract 1 and 2. So if I were to subtract off a 1 and subtract off a 2, I'd be left with a sum from 3 to k. And so I can just take this sum, I equals 1 to k of I, and I can subtract off a 1 and subtract off a 2. And then I end up with a sum from I equals 3 to k of I by having removed those other two boundaries points. Is the lower boundary of the summation from k to k plus 1 supposed to be I equals 2? I assume we're talking about this one, because I think this is the only one I have with k plus 1. Oh, this one also has it. So in this case, do I need a 2? No, because I've added a term and not removed any. So here I have taken this thing, which is 1 plus 2 plus etc. plus k, and I've added in k plus 1 to get a sum of 1 plus 2 plus 2, 3 plus whatever plus k plus 1. So all I have done is added a term. I don't need to change the lower boundary. The only time I'm going to change the lower boundary is if I have removed something from the low end instead. So because here I've just added an extra term, I don't need to change the lower boundary, only the upper boundary. Other questions? Okay, we're going to come back and try applying this in this case. I have this assumed to be true expression, and I want to change the boundaries here. So what I'm going to do to get there is I'm going to take that assumed true expression that I know is true by the inductive hypothesis, by the assumption that I had it true at the lower cases. I'm going to rewrite that here. And then I'm going to add to both sides, using the niceness of algebra, that I can add the same thing to both sides, this k plus 1, to create something that is still true. I assumed this was true, and so adding the same thing to both sides of it needs to result in another true expression. As we just saw, we can rewrite this piece as the sum of I equals 1 to k plus 1 I, because all I have done is added one more term to my sum. On the other side, I now need to combine all of these pieces, which is a little bit awkward. So I'm going to multiply out and then refactor to try to get where I'm going. So this was k squared plus k over 2. I want to get that in there as well. So that's going to be 2k plus 2 over 2. How would I justify the rewriting? Each of the steps I am doing using algebra rules. So here, this rewriting, I am using the definition of summation. I have one more term added to my sum, so it just becomes that sum. And literally in a proof, I wouldn't provide a justification. I would just say this sum is the same as that. Or possibly if I really felt like I was being verbose, I would say something like, because k plus 1 would be the next term in the sum, we can rewrite it as this other sum. On this other side, I am just multiplying out and using some algebra there. I don't know if that answers the question. Follow-ons to that question or more you would like me to say about justifying these steps. Okay. So this side over here, I've got a little bit more work to do before I can get to the final form I want. I need to combine these pieces. So I have k squared plus 3k plus 2 over 2, which I can then factor out to get my k plus 1, k plus 2 over 2, which I need to finish my theorem. And so this is an outline of the proof by induction of this theorem. I know it's true at 0 and 1, 1 being useful because it's in the normal behavior of the sum. And then if it was true at some place where the normal behavior of the sum applies, then it's also true at the next place where the normal behavior of the sum applies. Shouldn't we add negative 1 to the base case since we are inducing by adding 1 to the base case? Yeah, do I need a negative 1? So I defined my theorem to be for all natural numbers. So it is true that my proof does not show that the theorem holds at negative 1. And so if I wanted to prove the theorem that it held for negative 1, then I would need to make that a base case. My inductive step just goes from 1 to bigger numbers. But because I only claimed it was true for natural numbers, I don't need to show the negative 1 case for this particular theorem. Other questions? Okay. So, sums naturally appear when we're trying to count behavior in a program. Many loops, if we want to count the things going on in the loop, whether that's allocating memory or doing work, we're going to end up summing for the number of times loop runs over whatever kind of work is done inside the loop. So we end up with a lot of sums coming out of our analysis of programs. And so if we want to formally prove various properties about code, we're going to need to be able to prove the convergence of these sums. What do they converge to? And so this is the general approach we're going to use. Let's do another example, a somewhat different example, though we're still going to prove it by induction because that's generally how this is going to work. So let's take a different looking sum. We're going to take the sum. We're going to still use I equals 1 to n. We're going to do 1 over 2 to the I. Okay, what does this mean? Let's just think about the first few examples of this case. So if I is 1, then this is going to be the sum of just one value, 1/2. If I is 2, then it's going to be 1/2 plus 1/4, which is to say 3/4. If I is 3, it's going to be 1/2 plus 1/4 plus 1/8, which is going to be 7/8. A few examples of what this sum looks like. And our theorem is going to be that this is going to be equal to 1 minus 1 over 2 to the n. We can see that this is true. At the case of 1, this is 1 minus 1/2. At the case of 2, this is 1 minus 1/4. At the case of 3, this is 1 minus 1/8. So we can see for our three example inputs, this seems to be true. We're going to prove it And we're going to prove it using the same technique we have used thus far. We're going to prove it by induction. So we're going to say for all n in the positive integers, not including zero, we're going to claim that this theorem holds. The structure is going to be just like our last proof. Our base case is going to be the smallest value, I equals one. That's already in sort of the normal behavior of the sum space. So we're not going to have to worry about anything special. In this case, our sum on this side, I equals one to n, is of this value, 1/2 i, is equal to 1/2. And 1 - 1/2 n is also equal to 1/2, finishing our base case. For our inductive step, we're going to again do what we always do in our inductive step. We're going to assume that the theorem is true at some value and prove that it implies it is true at the next value. So we're going to assume a sum of I equals 1 to k, 1/2 i, equals 1 - 1/2 k. And we're going to try to prove that this would be true for k plus 1. We're going to do it the same way we've done it before. We're going to add something to both sides of the equation that will change the boundaries from k to k plus 1. So we can show the sum applies at the next step. So we need to add to both sides of the equation the next missing term. The next missing term is this expression evaluated at k plus 1. So we're going to add to both sides 1/2 k + 1, being added to both sides of that. And again, how did I pick this? I have a sum. It has an upper limit of k. I want to show the sum also holds, the equation also holds an upper limit of k plus 1. So I add the next term in this sequence, right? If k was 3, for example, I would be adding the 16th term to get me to 4. And so that is this expression. It's the expression here evaluated at the next limit that I reach for I. I add that to both sides. This left-hand side then, by construction, I picked this value explicitly to ensure that I could do this. That's how I picked the thing to add. And so now I just need to show that this right-hand side turns into the value I want. And so to do this, I want it to be a 1, but I want to get the other thing into just a subtraction. So I'm going to rewrite this with a common denominator by multiplying top and bottom by 2. And then by adding these two values, I end up with 1 - 1/2 k + 1, which was what I wanted to show. And so I have now shown my inductive case, or outlined it. I'm, of course, missing some of the language I put in a formal proof here, but I have an outline of how this proof would work. Questions about any of these steps? I went a lot faster here. I expect there are some things that I should review. Questions about any of my pieces here? Can you explain why that last step worked? Sure. The right-hand side worked by construction. I picked the next term, and I added in and it changed the boundary. I can say more about that if you want, but if you want that, let me know in the chat somehow. Otherwise, I'm going to talk more about this right-hand side. I had 1 - 1/2 k + 1/2 k + 1. I had this because I started with what I assumed and I added the same thing to both sides. And now I need to show, I need to simplify this expression. I'm not really interested in the one. I want the one to remain. I had it before. I want to keep it. So I want to sort of combine these two pieces. But to add two fractions, I need to have them have a common denominator, which means I need them to both have the 2 to the k plus 1 denominator. Well, 2 to the k plus 1 is the same thing as 2 times 2 to the k. Right? Because that'd be 2 to the 1 times 2 to the k, and so those things work. So that means I need to multiply the denominator of my left-hand side by 2 to get the denominator I want. But to multiply the denominator by something, I have to multiply the numerator by it as well. So I have 2 times 1 over 2 times 2 to the k, leaving everything else the same. And then I'm going to combine and simplify that to give me 1 over 1 minus 2 over 2 to the k plus 1, plus 1 over 2 to the k plus 1. And now I need to do my summing. I had a minus 2 and a plus 1. So when I combine those, I end up with, one way of thinking about this is I have minus 2 plus 1 over 2 to the k plus 1, which then simplifies down into 1 plus minus 1 over 2 to the k plus 1, which turns into 1 minus 1 over 2 to the k plus 1. I hope that's what was wanted here. Any other pieces you would like me to say more about? Let me sort of editorialize here a bit. I'm guessing that when you last saw this kind of manipulating fractions and so on, for many of you was some time ago, and you thought you wouldn't need to see it again. And I'm sorry. You're going to keep seeing it. This kind of algebra is part of proving lots of various numerical properties about code. And so in this class and then subsequent classes, computational theory is particular, but the algorithm analysis and so forth, you'll keep seeing this kind of work. And so if you're a little rusty on some of your algebra rules, you might want to pull out some practice problems from earlier things and sort of refresh you a little bit on that, so that these steps can be more straightforward. I will try to keep the complexity of the algebra in check in the sorts of things we're doing so you can focus on the proving. But as you move forward, this will continue to be something you'll need to know. And probably, for many of you, something you learned and then conveniently forgot to make room for other information. So sorry if that's where you are, and if not, huzzah, you have a use for it. Okay. So, let me say one more thing about this theorem itself. I have this theorem. This theorem tells me something about a different sum, a related but distinct sum. What if I sum from I equals 1 to infinity? 1 over 2 to the I. Well, infinity is not an integer. So infinity is not actually covered by my theorem. But numbers arbitrarily close to infinity are covered by my theorem. I can get as close to infinity as I want with my theorem. And as I do, I see that this thing I'm subtracting from 1 gets arbitrarily close to 0, and very quickly close to 0. Gets twice as close to 0 with each subsequent integer. And so as I approach infinity, my answer is approaching just the number 1. This is an example of what is called an infinite geometric series, a topic that is discussed in more detail in some calculus courses. They show up relatively uncommonly in programming. It is unusual to want to know an infinite sum. But there are various things in the real world that are best approximated by infinite series. And so sometimes there are cases in code where you want to understand that the infinite series converges so that you can use a shorter approximation of it in what you're doing. So these infinite sums, the textbook talks about several methods of dealing with this and perturbation methods and so forth, which you're welcome to read about. They may occasionally be useful. Besides sort of pointing out that they can exist and they can converge, we're not going to say much more about infinite sums in this class. You'll see them occasionally in later courses, but fairly rarely. However, these finite sum convergences are going to show up quite often. To understand how a finite set of steps will handle something will be useful in analyzing all kinds of looping and recurring code. And so we're going to use that quite a lot in this discipline. All right, that is the time I have. When we come back on Wednesday, we will use part of the day Wednesday again to see if the sort of in-class quiz infrastructure works. And then we will also move on and talk some more about combinations and so forth. I do have a parting thought asking about, will you be able to pick topics for the final exam? Yes, you will, as well as for the exam that will be theoretically scheduled the last day of class. So you'll have multiple opportunities to pick topics and take just those topic to replace grades. When should we expect the last in-class quiz to be put in the grade book? So the hope is that I'll be able to grade that very quickly. Oh, sorry, I don't know what we mean by last. I think we mean last week's. If we mean the one we had before break, the TAs and I are meeting virtually to grade that tomorrow, and so we should have that available by end of day tomorrow for you. Whole lot more things. All right, will the retake grades replace topics even if you do worse? Yes, they will. Are the final exams open note? Yes, because we are not doing anything in person, everything is open note. All right, if you have additional questions, feel free to let me know. I have used more than your scheduled time, so I will be in touch via the usual methods. I have some office hours later this afternoon, I believe, and I will see you all on Wednesday.